Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome back to Behind the Knife's Absite Review Series. I just want to thank everyone for making us the number one study guide on Amazon, and our book is also the number one Absite review book. So thank you guys for all that support. I hope it's helping you. I hope it's adding and reinforcing the principles you're learning in the podcast, as it is our notes directly from 5 years of residency that we use to make the podcast. If you haven't got it, make sure you check it out on Amazon. I think it's helpful, and I think that is demonstrated by how popular it has been. Well, here we go. We're going to dive into colorectal today, and we do have a few new episodes coming for you at the end of this series.
All right, colorectal board review. I hope everybody's studying is going well. So let's jump right into it with some high-yield anatomy. So, Wu, when thinking about the colon, what parts of the colon are retroperitoneal?
That's the ascending colon and the descending colon.
Correct. Okay. And another highly testable subject area is the blood supply to the colon. So let's just kind of walk through it. Let's start with the SMA. Kevin, what branches come off the SMA, and what parts of the colon do they provide blood flow?
Yeah, so the SMA provides blood flow to most of the bowel, and then the terminal branch of the SMA is actually the ileocolic. And then also more proximal to that, coming off the SMA, you have your right and your middle colic.
Okay, and what parts of the bowel does the SMA supply?
The SMA supplies the entire small bowel and the ascending and part of the transverse colon.
Okay, so then let's move down to the IMA. Wu, what are the branches of the IMA?
Yeah, so the IMA then leads to the left colic, the sigmoid branches, and the superior rectal artery.
Okay, and what parts of the colon does the IMA supply?
That's your distal part of the transverse colon, as well as the descending and sigmoid.
Okay, so that SMA, IMA, is there anything that provides a collateral flow between the SMA and IMA?
Yes, so the marginal artery runs along the margin, and this actually allows a collateral flow between the SMA and IMA. And then there's also a more direct connection, which is generally called the arc of Riolan, and it's a short direct connection between the SMA and IMA. It's in the mesentery of the colon.
Okay. What are the watershed areas of the colon, Wu?
Yeah, so in your splenic flexure, you have Griffith's point, which is the connection between the SMA and IMA. And then you have in the rectum, Sudex point, which is where the superior and middle rectal parts connect.
Yep, Griffith's and Sudex point.
Okay. And this is important if they're talking about a patient that was hypotensive, and you know where you'd expect to potentially see the areas of infarct. These are the areas that will have the least blood flow.
Yep, especially in kind of like your low flow type situations. Okay, Wu, let's keep moving down the track and talk about blood supply to the rectum.
Here you have the superior, middle, and inferior rectum. So the superior is supplied by the superior rectal branch of the IMA. The middle is supplied by the middle rectal branch of the hypogastric or internal iliac artery. And it runs lateral, it runs in the lateral stalks. And finally, in the inferior portion, you have the inferior rectal artery, which is a branch of the pudendal off the internal iliac.
And one thing they often like to ask is the venous drainage of the rectum. So where do those different parts of the rectum drain into?
Yeah, so the superior and middle rectal veins drain into the IMV, and that's into the portal circulation, whereas the inferior rectal vein drains into the internal iliac vein into the systemic circulation.
So that's a very important, it's one of those anatomic things that has a real clinical relevance when it comes to your start thinking about the metastasis and spread of tumors. So yeah, very important to know. Superior and middle rectal veins drain into your portal circulation through the IMV, and your inferior rectal vein drains into the internal iliac into your systemic circulation. So yes, very important.
And so one thing that you want to think about is when you have a distal rectal cancer, that you want to make sure you're doing a good groin evaluation to palpate nodes, because that could be potentially where metastases are going, rather than what we normally think about for colorectal cancer, which would be the liver.
Okay, so we're talking, you know, about the colon and the rectum. So where does the colon end and the rectum begin, Wu? Yes. Anatomically.
So anatomically, the rectum starts where the tineus splay, and it starts there and goes until the anal canal. So typically, this is about 15 centimeters from the anal verge on rigid proctoscopy.
Perfect. Okay. So you said from the tineus splay to the anal canal. So then what defines the anal canal?
Yeah. So the anal canal begins at the puborectalis sling, and it ends at the squamous mucosa where that blends with the perianal skin.
Okay. And then the another thing we need to define from there is the anal margin. What defines the anal margin?
Mm-hmm. So if you take 5 centimeters radially from that squamous mucocutaneous junction and extend it out laterally, that's the anal margin.
Okay. And so just keep these in mind. These are going to become important as we go on to talk about different colorectal and anal tumors a little bit later in this podcast.
If only we could link a video of Dr. Steele doing the little man walking up the anus to demonstrate all the areas, it would be quite helpful.
Yeah, maybe that's a separate podcast where we have Steele talk about his little man walking through the anal canal. But that's a story for another day. Okay, so let's move on to some pathology. So very, very common are anal fissures. Every general surgeon is going to see them in their practice. So Wu, what are some basics when it comes to anal fissures?
Yeah, so 90% of these are located within the posterior midline. Females can have anterior fissures in about 25% of cases, but again, think posterior midline is the most common. The first line treatment for these is medical, non-operative management. You start with psyllium or other bulking agents with sitz baths, plus or minus a topical anesthetic. If that fails, you can add on a topical nitrate, which can be helpful, but often is accompanied by side effects like headaches, which are not tolerated very well. In that case, you can try a topical calcium channel blocker, which has a similar efficacy to topical nitrates, but with fewer side effects.
Yep. So perfect. So your initial management is bulking the stool, sitz baths, topical anesthetics, your nitrates or your calcium channel blockers, and what's another? With all these things, we always start with the least invasive and go to more invasive. What's the next step after that?
The next step would be Botox injection, which has a modest healing rate for those that fail with topical therapy.
Okay, Kevin, what about surgical therapy for anal fissure? What are our options?
Right. So you can do the classic is the lateral internal sphincterotomy. So this has a very high efficacy rate, much higher than non-operative methods. However, the big risk of this is a large one is fecal incontinence. So I've actually, I guess it's not as absite pertinent, but a lot of times they'll try Botox first and see if it helps and if they are going to develop fecal incontinence with the Botox injections. If they do, that does not make them a candidate for the sphincterotomy. But then there's also the anocutaneous flap. This is where you basically make a flap and cover the fissure. And with this, it has inferior healing rates, but the incidence of fecal seepage incontinence is very low. And this can be performed in addition to other procedures such as the Botox injections or the sphincterotomy.
Yep. So yeah, your lateral internal sphincterotomy, it has high efficacy rates. It's a very small risk of fecal incontinence. But like as you mentioned, you want to be sure that you definitely evaluate the patient's continence before the operation. So women with childbearing age who have had prior obstructive injuries, inflammatory bowel disease, or any history of sphincter dysfunction incontinence would be a contraindication to doing that procedure. And the anocutaneous flap is often added in addition to some of these other procedures. Okay, so moving on from there, let's go to another very common colorectal pathology, which is the anal rectal abscess or the fistula in ano. We'll start with anal rectal abscesses. So, Wu, abscesses are defined really by the anatomic space that they occupy. So what are our different classifications of anal rectal abscesses?
Yeah, you can think of these as falling into 5 different spaces. There's the perianal space, the ischiorectal space, intersphincteric space, supralevator space, and the submucosal space.
Yeah, so this is, you really have to have kind of a intimate knowledge of the anatomy. There's a good surgical clinics of North America article I would point everybody to that really lays out anal rectal anatomy. It's a very thorough, very great article. If you haven't read it, go read it. It makes understanding all these disease processes much easier. You just kind of have to picture the anatomic location. So not something we're going to be able to convey over an audio format, but you just understand that you need to have a good knowledge of the different anatomic locations or the anatomic spaces in the for anal rectal anatomy. So yeah, perfect. Those are your different areas for anal rectal abscesses. We all know that if there's pus, it must be drained. So what are the what is the primary treatment for anal rectal abscesses?
The primary treatment is going to be surgical drainage. And again, think about those spaces. If you have an abscess in the superficial perianal or ischiorectal spaces, then external IND will suffice. However, if you have a deeper abscess, which is occupying the inner sphincteric or supralevator spaces, then you may need to do internal transanal drainage.
Okay, so Kevin, these patients that you drain these anal rectal abscesses on, do they need antibiotics?
The vast majority of them do not, but if patient has significant cellulitis, if they have systemic signs of infection, such as fevers and chills, or they have some underlying immunosuppression that they're on, you'd want to put them on antibiotics.
Okay, so will you do a drainage of a perirectal abscess, and later the patient comes back to you and they say they have a little fecal seepage from a wound just outside of their anus. They're wondering if you did something wrong when you drained your abscess. Did you cause an iatrogenic injury? What's that all about?
You actually think about a fistula in ano. About a third of these patients post-abscess will develop a fistula.
Yeah, it's always important to warn the patients if they present with an anorectal abscess that about a third, 33% or 30% of patients will go on to develop fistula in ano. Because you can imagine that's quite distressing to them when that does occur. So let's talk about fistula in ano. So Wu, you went over the different anatomic locations of abscesses. Again, need to know the anatomy. What are the different, how do we define fistulas?
Yeah, so I think of this as there are five again. The fifth is still submucosal, but the other four are in relation to the sphincter muscle. So you can have an intersphincteric, a transsphincteric, suprasphincteric, or an extrasphincteric fistula in ano.
Yep, and so treatment of these can be challenging, and it depends a lot on the individual patient, and on, again, it depends heavily on the anatomy. So, but in general, Kevin, what are some principles for treatment of fistula in ano?
Right. And for the abscite, they're not going to get too crazy about this, but for a superficial simple fistula with minimal or no sphincter involvement, you can just do an incision, open the tract up essentially, and whether if it's a little bit of sphincter, be a little bit of a sphincterotomy. So fistulotomy is okay in these patients if it has minimal sphincter involvement or just submucosal.
Okay. What about if it involves more of the sphincter? Let's say it involves 25% of the sphincter.
So we're generally pretty conservative on these patients. We'll generally just drain the abscess if there is one still, and then just place a seton.
Okay. What is this? What's a seton? What does it do?
So generally, it's just a vessel loop that we put in there and tie to itself. So you have a loop that is in there. And what that causes is it has the tract allows it to fibrose. And this is the goal is to convert a high fistula to a low fistula and prepare the tract for later procedures. A lot of times, it'll actually resolve a lot of their symptoms because it fibroses and doesn't have the same inflammatory state that it did before.
Right. It seems a little counterintuitive. You want to keep that tract open so that it's draining, control the inflammation, have a foreign body reaction and allow fibrosis of the tract. And like you said, the goal is to convert that high sphincter to a low sphincter, which can then be treated with a procedure. What's a good procedure other than fistulotomy? What's another option?
Yeah, one that is coming in vogue and I think is pertinent on the abscite now is the LIFT procedure. The ligation of intersphincteric tract is a good option for fistulas not amenable to simple fistulotomy.
Yep, and that's, again, after you've induced that, you need that fibrosis, you need that tract to mature, you need the inflammation, you need to control the inflammation. But yeah, that's a great, the LIFT, ligation for intersphincteric tract. We hear a lot about these fistula plugs, fibrin glue, all those different options. What do you think about those?
Yeah, we'd actually steer you away from answering whether it's a fistula plug or a fibrin glue on the boards or the abscite.
Right. High recurrence rates. They can cause some complications, pain, infection. It's a little bit controversial. There are people out there using it, but for the boards, I would stick with fistulotomy if it has minimal sphincter involvement, placing setons for the higher fistulas, and your LIFT procedure.
And then one other procedure is the anorectal advancement flap. This is also a reasonable choice, but all of these procedures will be preceded by a seton. So it's really important that if it involves significant sphincter muscle, you choose a seton first.
Yeah, and a lot of people are adding the advancement flap to procedures. So you perform a lift with the advancement flap would be a good option. Okay, let's move right into diverticulitis. So Wu, what's the Hinchey classification for diverticulitis?
So the Hinchey classification has 1, 2, 3, and 4. Class 1 is a pericolic abscess. Class 2 is a pelvic abscess. Class 3 is purulent peritonitis. And class 4 is feculent peritonitis.
Yeah, that's the classic, you know, Hinchey classification. That's it's probably not so important to know for the boards, but it's important to have that kind of those different severities in your mind when thinking about treatment, and it's certainly pimpable on rounds. Not likely to ask you the Hinchey classification on the boards, but Kevin, what constitutes complicated diverticulitis?
Right, and this is the important differentiation in diverticulitis. So if you have a perforation, if you have an abscess, you have fistula, you have an obstruction or stricture, these are generally the cases of the complicated diverticulitis is when surgery gets involved.
Yep, again, perforation, abscess, fistula, obstruction, stricture, complicated disease. What about if you just have a large phlegmon or maybe have a little extraluminal gas on your CT scan? Is that considered complicated disease?
It is not. Most of these will still resolve with antibiotics. And Jason, just for our more junior listeners out there, can you describe what a phlegmon is? I've never, when I was earlier in my years, had a hard time understanding that.
Sure. So phlegmon on a CT scan is basically just an area where you see a lot of inflammation. So you see kind of a contained area of a lot of inflammation, not necessarily an abscess, not a big fluid collection, but it's a ball of inflamed tissue that you can see on the CT scan. Okay, so let's move on to some principles for treatment. So Wu, let's say you have a patient who presents with uncomplicated diverticulitis, who's a clinically stable, reliable patient, and they tell you that they're able to drink liquids okay. How do you want to treat that patient?
So this patient might be amenable to outpatient treatment with oral antibiotics. You want to make sure you cover gram-positive and gram-negatives. So something like Augmentin or levoflagyl would be a good option.
Okay. So let's step it up a little bit. So let's say a patient presents with complicated disease. So maybe they have an abscess on their CT scan, and they're really not tolerating a whole lot of PO intake.
And these patients should be admitted and started on IV hydration and IV antibiotics such as Zosyn or levoflagyl.
Yep. And then we'll move into a little bit more of some other treatments. Those patients may require percutaneous drainage or even an operation, but we'll get into that here in a little bit. Kevin, so what do you do for your unstable patient who has diffuse peritonitis?
So this patient clearly needs to go to the operating room. In that case, you do a sigmoidectomy, likely with a Hartmann's procedure, where you remove the sigmoid, you divide the rectum and leave the rectal stump in the pelvis and bring up an end colostomy.
Yeah, I think on the boards, it's the safest answer for somebody with diffuse peritonitis, your Hinchey 3 or Hinchey 4. Certainly, there's a lot of literature out there that supports primary anastomosis in select patients, even with Hinchey 3, Hinchey 4. But I think for the abscite, in that situation, I think I would still answer a Hartmann's procedure. What do you guys think?
And as we've discussed, they probably are not going to make you choose between the two. It's a complicated scenario. And I think if you ask Dr. Steele or any of the other colorectal surgeons, they'd say the answer nowadays is primary anastomosis with diverting loop. But I think on the abscite, I would still do Hartmann's.
Yeah, it would depend on the individual scenario. But certainly if they give you an older patient who's unstable, I still think that's the safest answer. And in these board scenarios, you always want to go with the safest answer. We're not saying in real life the primary anastomosis doesn't happen or that that's wrong, but on the boards, I would probably still do the Hartmann's. Wu, what about, you hear a lot about laparoscopic lavage.
I would not do a laparoscopic lavage on a test right now. If you're operating in the urgent or emergent setting, you really should do a resection.
Yeah, stay away from laparoscopic lavage on the boards. A lot of controversy, controversy concerning the literature for laparoscopic lavage, so I would not do that on the boards. What about a stable? So we did the easy one, the patient who shows up unstable, diffuse peritonitis. Okay, that's easy. You go to the operating room. What about a stable patient who has an abscess? How do you manage that patient?
Here I would think about the size of the abscess. Generally about 3 centimeters is a good cutoff. If the abscess is less than 3 centimeters, these generally resolve with antibiotics, but anything larger than 3 centimeters should be considered for percutaneous drainage.
Yeah, in reality, you're going to talk to your interventional radiologist and see if they can get there, if they think they have a good target. But but generally, yeah, I think 3 centimeters is that good cutoff. Less than 3 centimeters is a good chance that's going to resolve with antibiotics alone. Greater than 3 centimeters, you should think about percutaneous drainage. So, Kevin, what about, let's say you have a patient who has a 5-centimeter abscess, they're stable. You talk to your interventional radiologist, they're like, I just don't have a good window, I can't get there. What do you want to think about in that situation?
So this may be one of the few situations that you consider a laparoscopic drain placement.
Laparoscopic drain placement would be the answer there. So the goal with all of these is to kind of, you know, let the acute phase, the acute inflammation resolve so that the patient can then undergo an elective single-stage colectomy at a later date and maybe avoid that ostomy. So, let's say you have a patient who has a single episode of uncomplicated diverticulitis seen on a CT scan. You're able to successfully treat them non-operatively with antibiotics. And then, so what's the next step?
So about 6 weeks following resolution, I would take this patient for a colonoscopy. You want to rule out any underlying neoplasm or any ischemia or inflammatory bowel disease.
Yep, that's exactly right. So these patients aren't done just because they get better. So all these patients, provided that they haven't just had a recent colonoscopy, need a colonoscopy, you typically wait about 6 weeks for all that inflammation to go down. And like you said, you want to rule out. The big thing would be a colon cancer, perforated colon cancer, and not just simply diverticulitis, but also ischemia, inflammatory bowel disease. Kevin, when should you recommend these patients undergo sigmoid colectomy?
Right. This is a difficult question, and it has changed over the past 10 years. It used to be based on the number of episodes and the age of the patient. However, we now know that the first episode tends to be the worst, and that multiple uncomplicated episodes do not necessarily increase the risk of needing an emergent colectomy or a stoma, which we previously thought that if you're having multiple episodes, you'd kind of tell the patient they have a risk of getting a stoma if they get another episode of this, and that would kind of push patients towards colectomy. In my personal experience, it's been patients that have kind of smoldering diverticulitis that they have a stricture from their diverticulitis are kind of the most common cases and when we're doing elective sigmoid colectomies. But you know, if it's a younger patient in their 30s or something and they're already getting diverticulitis, this might be a patient, or you know, we've had police officers and things like that that don't, and soldiers that don't want to deal with this and worry about this. And so it's really a discussion of how does this affect your lifestyle? Are you okay if you have to come in and get antibiotics again? Should this happen again? Or is that too concerning for you? So those are generally how I think of it.
Yeah, I think you're right there. I think the answer used to be pretty easy. So like I said, it used to be based, there was criteria based on the patient's age and number of episodes. But now the decision for elective colectomy is highly individualized. So it does involve, you know, a conversation with the patient, consideration of the risk versus benefits of surgical intervention. Like you said, so certainly things like suspicion for a neoplasm, if they have chronic symptoms, that smoldering disease, that would lean you in the direction of intervening. But you have to have a conversation with the patient and talk about the effect of the diverticulitis on their lifestyle and consider the comorbidities and general health of the patient. So it's a much harder question than it used to be. So it's unlikely to be a question. They'll give you that kind of gray area scenario. It's going to be obvious on the exam. What about for uncomplicated disease? What about for complicated diverticulitis? When do those patients need a surgery?
Yeah, for all these patients, after they've recovered from the complicated episode of diverticulitis, they should be offered an elective colectomy.
Yeah, so your patient that comes in and they have an abscess and you successfully percutaneous drain it, those patients should be offered an elective colectomy after they recover from their episode of diverticulitis. Okay, moving on. Let's talk about C. diff infections, Clostridium difficile infection. What is this?
So C. diff is an anaerobic gram-positive rod. It's a common cause of infection in the hospital setting, especially following antibiotic administration.
Okay. So, yeah, seeing it more and more common as with widespread use of antibiotics. But So what are your principles and of medical management for C. diff infections?
So for medical management, you would start with metronidazole and vancomycin. These are the mainstays of medical treatment. As far as the dosing goes, for metronidazole, you could do 500 milligrams TID oral if the patient can tolerate it. And for vancomycin, this should be also given orally as opposed to an IV administration because of the way it needs to penetrate into the gut. So for vancomycin, you can do 125 to 500 milligrams QID. You can generally treat with both flagyl and vanc for 10 to 14 days. If PO is not a good option, vanc enemas can also be administered. And some recommend metronidazole for mild to moderate disease and to reserve vancomycin for the more severe disease. But really, there's not enough evidence to suggest one over the other.
Yeah, so this is kind of a common question. They'll give you somebody with C. diff, and they'll ask you how you want to treat them. And they'll list all those options, kind of flagyl, vanc, oral, and IV. What would be the first one you would go for on the test, do you think?
Flagyl.
Yeah, I think if the patient's tolerant PO, that would be my first choice as well, is oral, unless it's a severe disease, oral metronidazole, and then kind of step up from there. What's a newer antibiotic out there that people might see?
Yeah, fidaxomicin is an oral macrolide. It's a newer antibiotic with activity against C. diff. These are mostly used for resistant strains.
Yeah, and that usually is after infectious disease gets involved and is probably not yet the answer on the boards. So, Kevin, what about patients with a refractory C. diff infection?
Yeah, this is very pertinent for the boards, I believe. And this is when you would consider a fecal transplant.
Yep, fecal transplant for refractory C. diff. Where does surgery come into play for C. diff?
Surgery, thankfully, is only for patients that fail to respond to medical therapy. So like most surgical indications, it's if they have a perforation or generalized peritonitis, sometimes they can go into multi-system organ failure and have a toxic megacolon picture. And these would be situations in which they would need an emergent subtotal colectomy. So those are generally the time you want to think about it.
Yeah. So in that situation with that patient with multi-system organ failure, you've waited too long. The decision to operate on these patients is difficult, but if you wait that long, that's a very ominous sign, as you say. So in those patients, you should consider early operative intervention in patients who are requiring vasopressors or who have signs of sepsis with a C. diff infection. And you mentioned it, but the procedure of choice?
So it'd be a subtotal colectomy, which what we mean by that is a total abdominal colectomy. You leave the rectum in place and you do an end ileostomy.
Yep, that would be the answer on the test. Talk to me a little bit about, people out there may have heard of the diverting, bringing up a diverting loop and doing colonic lavage.
Yeah, that's certainly an option, and it's being done in some institutions, and it has shown promise, and it's a lot less morbid than a subtotal colectomy and end ileostomy, but I don't think that is pertinent for the abdomen.
Yeah, that's really at select institutions, doing that DLI and the colonic lavage with antegrade vancomycin enemas. That is a surgical option. There is some literature out on that, but that hasn't worked its way into be the answer for the boards. Okay, woo. So let's move on from C. diff and let's start talking about some of the different colonic volvuluses. There's a couple different kinds. Just tell us the quick hits on that.
Yeah, so there's a sigmoid volvulus as well as a cecal volvulus. So let's start with the sigmoid volvulus. So radiographically, look for a bent inner tube sign. The apex of that inner tube is going to point towards the right upper quadrant. On a contrast enhanced CT, you can confirm the diagnosis as well as it's helpful to assess the colonic viability. If on this CT scan you see no colonic ischemia or perforation, the first step is endoscopic detorsion. So you're going to leave a decompression tube in place for about 1 to 3 days. There's a high long-term recurrence rate after the initial endoscopic decompression. So you should consider these patients for a sigmoid colectomy during the index admission in appropriate patients.
Yep. So again, as you said, that bent inner tube sign. So you see a big dilated colon with the apex pointing to the right upper quadrant. You get your CT, confirms. The first step in a stable patient is going to be endoscopic detorsion. But as you say, there's a high recurrence rate with that. So those patients should be considered for elective sigmoid colectomy. What about if, let's say, the patient perforates and you're operating emergently? What's your procedure going to be?
Here, I think the safe procedure to do would be the open sigmoidectomy with end colostomy. So the Hartmann's procedure would be the safe answer.
Okay. And how about if you're able to successfully detorge them? When do you want to operate them on them and what procedure do you want to do?
So this, it'd be ideal to operate in a semi-elective setting, and the answer would be a sigmoid colectomy with a primary anastomosis.
Okay, Kevin, what about a cecal volvulus? That's a little bit different. What do you want to do with these patients?
Right, and so this is, I think, 100% sensitivity to have a sigmoid or cecal volvulus on the abscite, so I would definitely go look at these images and know this well. Every year I've seen this. So a cecal volvulus, very different. This is a patient you do not want to do endoscopic reduction, rarely successful in high recurrence. So these patients need to go directly to the operating room.
What does this look like on imaging?
So this will be the coffee bean sign generally pointing towards the left upper quadrant.
Right. So make sure you know how to distinguish between these two on a plain radiograph because, as Kevin said, there's a high likelihood that you'll see this radiograph on test.
And I think there's a good clinical point that's actually you actually see in practice that's different. The sigmoid volvulus, you're generally going to have your nursing home patient that's either on antipsychotics or has long-term constipation and obstipation that comes in with a distended belly and they can't talk to you or tell you anything that's wrong with them. Whereas the cecal volvulus can be in kind of really anyone of any age.
Okay. So you talked about operating and you may need to do a resection. Talk to me the pros and cons about resection versus performing a PECSI of the volvulus.
Yeah, it's debatable. Each are possible and have been shown to be adequate. But on the boards, I would do a resection. So a ileocecectomy or right hemicolectomy would be the correct answer for this.
Yeah, I agree with that. So on the boards, I'd probably answer resection with a primary anastomosis for a cecal volvulus and stay away from the PECSIs. Definitely don't. They'll give you some options like cecostomy, endoscopic detorsion for cecal volvulus, or operative detorsion alone without doing anything, a PECSI or resection. Those are definitely the wrong answers. But for me, I think the answer would be a resection with a primary anastomosis.
And remember, if you're doing a right colectomy, even in emergent situations, you can always generally do a primary anastomosis and you do not need to divert.
Yeah. For right-sided, primary anastomosis without diversion would be a pretty safe answer. Okay, so let's move on to something called Ogilvie's syndrome. So, Kevin, what is Ogilvie's?
So, yeah, this is a pseudo-obstruction of the colon, which means you're going to have a dilated colon. That's concerning that there is an obstruction, but the workup will demonstrate that there is no obstruction. This is generally seen. I think the most common scenario you'll see, especially in the boards, is they'll have a patient that had spine surgery or knee surgery. And then they, 2 days after surgery, they start having abdominal pain and bloating and they get an x-ray and their colon is 10 centimeters and their cecum is maybe 12 or 13. So these are that's who you'll see this patient. And you also see it frequently in trauma, patients with spinal fractures, and then in patients that have electrolyte abnormalities or on high doses of opiates are at higher risk for this.
Great. So Wu, with Ogilvie's, what are some risk factors for perforation?
Yeah, the most significant risk factors would be a cecum that's massively dilated to over 12 centimeters or a duration greater than 6 days.
Yep, exactly. Especially that cecum greater than 12 centimeters. That's definitely increases your risk of that patient perforating. So, Kevin, what's some initial management for Ogilvie's? Let's say there's no signs of ischemia and your cecum is 10 centimeters.
Right. So for these patients, you're going to do supportive therapy, generally replace their electrolytes, minimize their opiates, fluid resuscitate would be the first thing I would do. Additionally, you want to make sure you're stopping anticholinergic medications, treat any infection, and definitely have the patients on bowel rest and consider nasogastric decompression.
Right. Yep. For those patients, you want to just kind of give them bowel rest, correct, try and identify what's causing the underlying pathology, electrolytes, fluid resuscitation, all the things you said, and try and reverse that. But let's say they don't respond to that.
Right. So if they don't respond to that and you have ruled out a distal obstruction with generally a colonoscopy or a flexible sigmoidoscopy, you can consider neostigmine to help decompress them.
Yep. So if they don't respond to your supportive care, that would be the next neostigmine. As you said, it's very, very, very important to make sure this is a pseudo obstruction and not an obstruction. So you do have to rule out a distal obstruction before you do that. What's a side effect of neostigmine?
Bradycardia. This is why you want to give neostigmine in a monitored setting.
Absolutely. Okay. And Kevin, you try that. They don't respond to the neostigmine. What's the answer on the boards?
Endoscopic decompression.
Yeah. So either they don't respond to the neostigmine, or for a cardiac reason, the neostigmine is contraindicated, endoscopic decompression. Let's say they have a massively dilated, their cecum is 16 centimeters, and there you see evidence of ischemia, or even if they have a perforation. How do you manage that patient?
So in this patient, you're going to take them to the operating room and resect.
Yeah, and the decision whether or not to do an ostomy versus a primary anastomosis, plus or minus diversion, that's really made on a case-by-case basis and unlikely to get that detailed into a board's answer. But yeah, obviously, as with anything in the colon, ischemia or perforation, you need to resect that. Okay, so our next topic is a rectal prolapse. So Wu, what is rectal prolapse and who does it affect?
So rectal prolapse is a full thickness intussusception of the rectal wall. There's a higher incidence of this in elderly females, the developmentally delayed, and psychiatric patients with multiple medications.
Yeah, so when they describe this to you, how do you distinguish rectal prolapse from prolapsed hemorrhoids?
So make sure you see all those concentric rings indicating a full thickness intussusception.
And how do you go about treating this? What are some principles of surgical therapy for rectal prolapse?
So first, you want to eliminate the prolapse through either resection or restoration of the normal anatomy. You want to correct any associated functional abnormalities. And finally, you want to avoid creation of de novo bowel dysfunction.
Good. Yeah, those are your goals of therapy. Kevin, how might you see this pop up on the boards?
Yeah, I think a good way to ask this is they may give you a severe rectal prolapse image, and it could actually just be hemorrhoids. So it's important to know the difference between severe hemorrhoids and rectal prolapse. But if you identify that it is truly rectal prolapse, I think the answer on the test will initially be just to reduce it for the time being and schedule them for an elective procedure.
Yep. And so like you said, surgical intervention is really the mainstay of treatment for rectal prolapse. How do you want to, there's a couple different options. So how do you want to go about sorting out your surgical approach?
Right. It really depends on the patient. If you have a young patient who has laxity due to previous obstetric operations, et cetera, these are patients you want to do a transabdominal rectal fixation, like with a rectopexy. Open versus laparoscopic, doesn't matter. But these are the patients you want to do rectopexy on. But if it's a patient that has very poor risk, a lot of these, the majority of the patients I've seen with this have been 80, 90-year-old nursing home patients. That these are the patients you want to consider the perineal rectosigmoidectomy.
Yep. So ideally, some type of transabdominal PEXI is the preferred procedure because of the lower recurrence rates. But in those really old, frail patients who may not be able to tolerate an abdominal surgery, the perineal approach is acceptable. It has a lower morbidity but a higher recurrence rate, so it's a less durable repair. Like I said, open versus laparoscopic, it's going to depend on surgical preference. They have pretty equivalent recurrence rates. There is improved morbidity with laparoscopic approach, but again, that's going to depend on the surgeon experience, whether an open or laparoscopic approach is used. But the rectopexy is really the key component of that procedure. How do you decide whether or not you want to do a resection with the rectopexy or a sigmoid resection, Wu?
Yeah, so if the patient has constipation, then you would consider doing a sigmoid resection at the time of the rectopexy.
Perfect. Okay, well, I think we're going to take a break. We're going to break this up into two sections because it's so long. But before we break, let's do a little quick hit rapid fire segment. So, Wu, what's the main energy source for colonocytes?
That would be short chain fatty acids like butyrate.
Yep, that's one of those simple ones. You just got to know. You don't want to get that one wrong. You got to pick up those points where you can. Kevin, so let's say you have a patient with the sigmoid volvulus seen on CT scan. You do an endoscopy and the mucosa appears a little dusky and there's some ulceration. What do you do in that situation?
On that, I would abort the endoscopy and take the patient to the OR for an urgent sigmoid resection. Do not attempt endoscopic detorsion if there are signs of colonic ischemia.
Perfect. You see signs of colonic ischemia on your endoscopy when you're going to detour, you stop, you take them to the operating room, you do a resection. Wu, so with a patient with an anal fissure, You mentioned before that 90% of these are in the posterior midline. Let's say you see one lateral, or let's say you see multiple anal fissures. What do you think about?
Here you should think about Crohn's disease. That's the major tip-off, but you can also get this with HIV, syphilis, or TB.
Yep, so lateral anal fissures or multiple anal fissures. The big one you should think about is Crohn's, as you say. Kevin, so you're doing an XLAP with a planned total abdominal colectomy in a patient who has C. diff colitis, refractory to medical management, and has some signs of sepsis. However, when you enter the abdomen, the entire colon appears completely normal. What do you do?
Yeah, because C. diff is a mucosal disease, you may not see obvious changes on the outside or the serosa of the colon. So in this patient, you'd still want to do a subtotal colectomy, which would be a total abdominal colectomy with an end ileostomy.
Yep. So many times the colon's going to look normal from the exterior. Like you say, C. diff is a mucosal process. So if you see that, you still proceed with your resection and end ileostomy. Perfect. We didn't talk much about this, but it's a big topic. So let's jump into it real quick. Is a lower GI bleed. So Swoo, walk me stepwise through your approach to a patient who presents with a lower GI bleed.
All right. So first think about your ABCs, make sure you start resuscitation, have two large bore IVs, type and cross, transfuse if necessary, admit the patient to ICU. Then you want to move towards localizing the source. And a lot of these are actually upper GI sources. So you want to start with an NG lavage and rule out an upper GI source. If that is clean, then you would move to a colonoscopy, plus or minus angiography and or tagged RBC scan to localize.
Yeah, there's different recommendations. And I tried to find one good recommendation for colonoscopy versus angiography versus tagged red blood cell scan and what order to do those. It's really institution specific. I think on the test, on the boards, I would go for colonoscopy definitely first. After you do those things you said, you do all the resuscitation, get your IV, type and cross, you know, all that. Like you say, first thing you have to do is rule out an upper GI source. But from once you do that, I think I would move to colonoscopy would be my first stop. So let's say you do your colonoscopy, you don't really localize the source, but the bleeding stops. Most of these will actually stop spontaneously, but the patient then re-bleeds. What are you going to do in that situation?
So for patients who are unstable or have an ongoing transfusion requirement, the answer would be a segmental colectomy if the bleeding source is localized on colonoscopy. If you have not localized, then you would do a total abdominal colectomy.
Yeah, I think if the patient is stable and you're able to, I think the first thing is going to do a second attempt of endoscopy. Again, you really want to try and localize these. So if you can try your localization studies again if they rebleed, and then if you are able to localize the source, do a segmental colectomy. If you still can't localize the source, then the answer is going to be a total abdominal colectomy.
All right, and that wraps it up for colorectal part one.
Hey, Drew Scott here. And I'm Jonathan Scott, reminding you that life's better with a home policy from American Family Insurance. They can help you get just the right protection at just the right price and help you save when you bundle home and auto. Kind of like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. It'll be just right for you. We love a custom build. American Family Insurance. Insure carefully. Dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.